It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll check out a new report on so-called sin taxes on cigarettes, beer, soda, and unhealthy foods. Our guest says they don't bring the benefits supporters say they will.
First, happy St. Patrick's Day to you. We're going to celebrate the day with a little Celtic-inspired rock and roll with the band Gaelic Storm. They've been around for years and became something of a super band after their appearance in the movie Titanic.
Gaelic Storm is performing tonight in Milwaukee at the Pabst Theater. Wisconsin turns out to be one of their most popular tour stops.
Steve Twigger is one of the band's founding members. You'll also hear him on guitar, mandolin, and some lead vocals. Steve, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for talking to me today.
Well, you're with the band Gaelic Storm, and this isn't a band that was born in a cozy pub in Ireland or Cornwall. Gaelic Storm got its start in Santa Monica, California. Can you tell us how Gaelic Storm came to be?
Yeah, we started in a cozy pub in Santa Monica. An Irish pub opened up just around the corner from me, and I was in there pretty much when the paint was still wet on the walls and met the lads there, fresh off the boat from Ireland. I'm from England, a lot of Irish, a lot of English lads in there, and we all got along great and formed friendships, and the band started out of those late-night drinking and storytelling sessions that always seemed to prevail.
And you'd been in a bunch of bands before then, though, right?
I always had a band on the side, as it were, since I was a teenager. Back in England, and then in Los Angeles, I had rock bands throughout my life. But it was really when I just stopped caring about how good we were and and who would see us, and just had fun that the whole thing took off with Gaelic Storm.
Well, Gaelic Storm today is known for mixing modern music with traditional music. What do you think fits you guys about that particular blend?
I think part of it was the fact that we'd emigrated to the United States. We were a long way from home, and I think there was a nostalgia factor built in. We certainly missed some of the music we grew up with. Even coming from the middle of England, I still grew up around a lot of Irish and I feel like I grew up in a pub, so of course all the pub music was part of my sort of musical upbringing. Like I said, when we started to get together, it was really, really the storytelling aspect of the folk music aspect of it, I think. We'd sit around in circles and we'd tell stories and pass the guitar around, and stories led to songs and songs led to stories. And that's really how the stage show has evolved.
Now, Gaelic Storm, as I understand it, kind of got catapulted into the spotlight with the hit movie Titanic. I mean, you'd been around performing and you did have a following, but Titanic really pushed that envelope. And you were the band that got to be in that famous party scene with Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet. How did that come about?
That was us, yeah. It was a Los Angeles sort of thing. None of us went to Los Angeles to be in the movies. You know, I was in advertising at the time. Patrick was in finance. And the musical director was out scouting for a band, and we were out playing at a little festival there on a Sunday afternoon. And he saw us, and he saw the party that erupted around us every time we played, and showed that to James Cameron, and he thought it'd be perfect. And once he realized that we ourselves were immigrants and fresh off the boat, as it were, he realized it would be perfect to actually be in the movie as well as just hear the music.
And that track you guys hadn't really recorded before, and it's called An Irish Party in Third Class. Let's listen to a bit. Like listening to this track so many years after Titanic?
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? I mean, obviously the movie's been on TV and I've seen it in the theater so many times. And you can't help but picture the people dancing around, spinning around the second you hear that music. You know, for us on set, it was that 3 minutes of on-screen time took four full 14-hour days.
Wow.
To film. So it was exhausting, but of course, so much fun, and now it's part of history, I guess.
Do you play that one out when you perform?
We have never played it on stage, no. You know, it's not that we were trying to get away from the Titanic, but we just felt like, you know, that was one small part of what we did on stage, and I was certainly playing music like that, with that spirit. But we, you know, we've been writing our own material since those days for 20 years now. So really, that's what fills our sets now. We have so many songs that people request that have become favorites from, you know, what will amount to 11 or 12 albums worth of music.
Another one of those favorite tracks that you're talking about is a track called Scalaway. Can you tell us about that one?
Yeah, you know, we actually wrote that for a little animated movie. It was actually a full-length feature movie that was being made. And the animators had taken one of our tracks from a previous album and used it to cut this one particular scene together. As I recall, it's I think three or four mice breaking into like a castle, and they wanted to use that, but we said, well, look, why don't we write something with that same framework, but an original piece for yourselves for this movie? So that's it. We sat with a rough animation, and I came up with the music and sat with Patrick, and we came up with this scenario that's now Scalaway.
Here it is.
They locked you in a tower and they threw away the key. But this tower's no match for a wag like me. I'll be sticking to the gate, I'll be peeking around the corner. Well, I've come to take your daughter, don't you say I didn't warn you. Bringing you a fiddle, I'll be singing you a song. We'll fiddle, sing, sing, fiddle all day long. And the halls and the walls, they will hear us sing and say, oh, back for the diddle, diddle, die, diddle, day. Come on away.
All right, a bit of Scalawag there. That's on your compilation track. Is there one on the CD that has a special place in your heart now that you're looking back over so many years of Gaelic Storm?
Goodness me, you know, I think the Russell Crowe song is a well-requested song, and it's nice to take something that is, you know, I mean, it's a true story, an event like that, and turn it into a song.
Right, I'm glad you mentioned that one. You talk about your storytelling history, and this is not something that comes from the canon of Gaelic folklore. This is a story, all right. Tell us about the night I punched Russell Crowe.
Yeah, it's, it's a Los Angeles type of story. It's the Irish pub there. A lot of movie stars would come in for a drink, and it certainly was a place where you left your stardom at the door. Nobody spoke about working there. It was a very unusual environment for Los Angeles, no networking in there. I was friends with people for 5 or 6 years before I knew what they did for a living in that place. So it was a nice little sanctuary in there. And everybody could act themselves, which I guess turned into a little bit of a fight when Russell Crowe decided that he would celebrate his... I think he just got the movie L.A. Confidential. He just booked that, and it was a big deal. It was the start of his super stardom. So it was a big night for him, and celebrating, and one thing led to another, and he started smoking a cigarette, and the no smoking law had just come into effect in Los Angeles, one of the first places, of course, that that law went into place. And, you know, he didn't want to put the cigarette out, so Patrick had to usher him, shall we say, gently to the door. And that's how the fight ensued. And, Russell, to his credit, made sure his bodyguard stood back and gave Patrick a free shot. and of course, Patrick, being the Irishman, took it. Thank you very much. I'll take that.
Here's a little bit.
To ending up dead was the night that I punched Russell Crowe, the gladiator in the head.
So how did it end, I got to ask you?
You know, it was Patrick actually ran away. Because Russell Crowe had bodyguards, these big Maori guys, the big New Zealand guys that you see, like the rugby players, big fella. And Patrick ran away, and this big guy tried to follow him, but Patrick was a little too fast for him.
And he's got this song as a memory.
Yes, we do, yeah. Yeah, well, of course, the story was bandied around for years and years and years before we decided, you know, let's just make a song of it and put it into the folk music lore then.
Now, Gaelic Storm is known for its intense touring schedule. Is there something special to you about performing live?
There is. You know, we when we first got together to play, we honestly literally said, you know what, let's do this, and we have a gig next Sunday. So we threw as much music as we could remember together, which wasn't a lot, and we just went out and played. And of course, you know, we'd forget things. We were not very good at some of the songs, and that created this very loose structure on stage where we could have fun with the music. We could stop in the middle and go, what are you playing? And talk to the audience, and we'd all just sort of laugh together. So the audience became almost part of the show every Sunday. And of course, over the course of time, our musicianship has improved, but we're still trying to keep up that connection, that immediacy with the audience. They really are. We consider them another part of the band. You know, they give their energy to us when we're out there, and it feeds back into the music and then back to them. So this is amazing sort of feedback loop of energy and goodwill.
Steve, thank you so much for joining us, and I hope you enjoy your time in Wisconsin.
Well, thank you. We love Wisconsin, by the way. It really is. It's the state that we've played most in the whole of the United States, and it's like coming home when we come back to Wisconsin.
Steve Twigger is a founding member of the band Gaelic Storm. They're playing tonight in Milwaukee at the Pabst Theater at 8 o'clock.
A new report out this month tries to track the impact of what are often called sin taxes. These are selective taxes on particular products, usually on healthy stuff like cigarettes, alcohol, or fatty and sugary foods.
The idea is that the resulting higher price will steer people away from the bad stuff and toward healthier options. But the new report finds that they don't necessarily work out that way and may hurt the people they're supposed to help.
Adam Hoffer is a co-author of this new study. He's an assistant professor of economics at the University of Wisconsin, La Crosse. Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So it seems like common sense, Adam. We boost the tax, increase the price of, you know, cigarettes, soda, you name it. People are going to be less likely to buy them. But you say when you crunch the numbers, it doesn't really work out that way.
Yeah, I think that's the basic intuition. And basic economics will tell us that anytime we have an increase in price from something like a tax, consumption will fall. One of the things that we really try to look at in this study is, by how much will that consumption fall? And what we observe is that the percentage decrease in consumption that results from any sort of tax is rather small, somewhere around 3 or 4% for every 10% increase in price. And so what ends up happening is a few people may stop consuming these targeted goods, but most people simply hand over the extra money to pay the tax.
And you also tried to look, I think, at substitution. Maybe some of the people who stop using the unhealthy stuff go to something else that is equally unhealthy but doesn't have that tax on it.
Sure. So we tried to look at, you know, if the ultimate aim of this policy is to incentivize people to switch from something unhealthy to something much more healthy, does that actually happen? Well, again, we observe that few people will actually switch, but then the people that do switch don't necessarily switch to what the policymakers want them to switch to. That is, we say that, you know, apple slices are a poor substitute for potato chips. In the shopping aisle, not many people that are going to buy potato chips will just simply switch to apples or fresh fruit or something like that.
So even if a lot of people aren't quitting, if they don't, well, the state or whichever taxing entity it is makes a little more money. Often that money might be earmarked toward health treatment, maybe defraying some of the bad outcomes from these unhealthy products. So it's a partial win then, isn't it?
Well, this is one area where economists are a little torn. So it's difficult for economists to say that simply because something generates more tax revenue, it's by definition a benefit, because what's happening is any of that tax revenue is by definition coming from the pockets of taxpayers. And really the second thing that we tried to look at in this study is, who are those taxpayers? Who are the taxpayers that are handing over this extra money that's going to be potentially used for whatever the state or policymakers would like to use it for? Most notably, we wanted to look at consumption of these goods across the income distribution. So do we see a lot of poor households? Do we see a lot of wealthy households? Who are really consuming these goods? And what we found is that the consumption of these goods is extraordinarily flat and persistent across the income distribution. What that means is, in dollar amounts, lower-income households spend on average almost the exact same amount on these goods as higher-income households. So when we look at who pays how much of the tax, we see that in dollar amounts, the tax is shared pretty equally among low-income households and higher-income households. And then as we take that as a percentage of their budget, this means that the lower-income households are paying substantially more of any of these taxes than the higher-income households. So these taxes are regressive, and regressive taxes tend to be sort of the opposite policy goal that we want from a tax policy that normally tends to try to be progressive.
So these don't necessarily have the health benefit, you're saying, but the impact of the extra taxes affects low-income people disproportionately among the population.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And one of the reasons why these lower-income households are so disproportionately affected is because they have the lowest income, so they have the fewest choices. If a higher-income household sees an extra or a higher price on some consumption good, they have more income to switch. They have a greater variety of options available. Not only do they have more options available because they have higher incomes, but often they literally may have access to more goods and services. That is, we see that a number of Americans, about 23.5 million Americans, live in what we call food deserts. That is, within a city, they're either a mile or more away from the closest supermarket, or in the suburbs, they're at least 10 miles from the nearest supermarket. So what this means is that they have the fewest choices. So while there may be a fast food restaurant or a convenience store rather nearby, it can be very difficult to access healthy alternatives.
Well, that kind of takes me into my next question. Assuming that there's a public health interest in discouraging unhealthy habits and that the government should be one of the entities promoting that, what would be a better alternative than these so-called sin taxes to encourage healthier options?
Sure, and I am completely on board. I think most economists and most people, you know, that may be listening to this radio station are on board with, we would like to promote a healthier public. And we would like to see decreased obesity and certainly avoid as many avoidable health negative health outcomes that we can. One of my favorite policies that we found while researching were government-supported farmers markets and trying to increase access to healthy alternatives, particularly to low-income households who may have difficulty getting to these goods. We've seen things like government-supported farmers markets that can pop up within a city in these urban food deserts that give lower-income households access to things like fresh vegetables and fresh fruits, things that it may take them hours to travel to and from a supermarket to get otherwise. That's always been one of my favorites that I've observed. A few other things we've observed globally, countries like Australia subsidize Nicorette gum. So if the goal is to stop people from smoking, we don't have to always use sticks. We can offer some carrots. We can give them other ways to, other rewards for switching as opposed to always sticking with the punitive policies.
I want to key in on cigarettes for just a moment. We've had health advocates on the show here say higher prices from higher taxes on cigarettes keep people from starting smoking, especially teens who legally shouldn't be able to get the cigarettes but seem to be able to. They have very limited discretionary income, so if you really bump up the taxes, they might be prevented starting in the first place.
Sure, and we see that teenagers are the most responsive group to price. When we break it down by age group, they are far more responsive than adults. So in terms of if we look at the breakdown of who the sin taxes affect more, they certainly affect teenagers far more than adults. I think one study found that it would take a couple hundred percentage point increase in the price to discourage a typical adult to actually stop smoking. So these effects can be larger in younger people than in older people.
As we wrap up briefly, Adam, do you see a trend in the nation toward more of these kind of sin taxes, or are we shying away from them now?
I think one thing that we've observed is that this is a growing and a popular trend for governments. I think it's a popular trend because it's one of the easier policy tools to put in place from government. And as an economist, I think we would like to, try to get policy in place, not necessarily that what is easiest to get passed. We'd like to see that which is most effective put into place.
Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on. Have a nice day.
Me too. That was Adam Hoffer. He's an assistant professor of economics at UW La Crosse. We've got a link to the paper he co-wrote on these sin taxes. It's at the Central Time Facebook page.
Members of the state legislature are having a busy Tuesday. The Senate and the Assembly are both in session, and both groups are tackling a hefty agenda, one which includes bills that would raise the state's speed limit, ban microbeads and personal care products, and bump back the start date for a new test that would judge school and teacher performance.
Here with us now to round up the latest legislative action is Patrick Marley. He's a state government reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So they're knocking out a lot of stuff today. If people are following this at home, there's a lot going on. Why do all these votes get compressed into one day?
Well, it's actually a fairly light agenda. Both the Assembly and Senate were out in a matter of a couple hours, and as you know, sometimes they can go all night. It just happens that the bills that they had up today were perhaps a little more public interest than some other days when they might pass a dozen or two bills that are something that doesn't garner a lot of media attention.
Well, one that's been getting a lot of attention, bills that deal with school and teacher performance. There's a test, this Badger test aligned with Common Core standards, and the legislature is pushing to put it on hold. Why and where does that stand now?
So the test would, this was approved by the Senate today and now goes to the Assembly. It appears to have pretty big support from both Republicans and Democrats and in both houses. This would not delay the actual test. Kids would still take this test this spring, but this would prevent the test from being used as a way to measure the rating of a school or used in performance evaluations for teachers. And the concern here is that this test is new. They're having some difficulties with some of the rollout of the test, and they're also, as part of the state budget, considering scrapping the test altogether and moving to something else. So nobody seems to want to use this test as a way to grade schools and grade teachers at this time.
And while we're on education, the Assembly was taking a look at a bill that could lead to the state's technical colleges establishing independent charter high schools. What did we see on that today? How did that work?
They were going to do that, but a little bit before the day got rolling, they decided to not address that bill at this time. So that'll come up at a later time. But certainly charter schools are something that Republicans who control the two houses are looking at broadly. There's a lot of moving parts with charters that there's a desire by them to allow more entities to authorize charter schools, and in this case, it would have given technical schools the ability to charter new schools.
And that one's tabled. It's not dead in the water, though.
It is not dead. It's just put off for another day.
Gotcha. And also something on remedial classes at the UW system. This one looked a little tricky, how they track high schools. What are they looking at here?
So there's a number of students, and it's gained some attention, who come into the University of Wisconsin system as well as colleges around the country and have to take remedial math or English courses. So this bill would simply require the UW to compile a report annually that says we had 10 students from this high school and 20 students from that high school around the state who had to take remedial courses. And then when that information became public, people would be able to monitor that their local high schools either did a good job and didn't have a lot of students who had to then take remedial courses, or they had a high rate of that and maybe they have an issue that they need to address at the high school level. This wouldn't provide any details about particular students who took it. It would just be aggregate information that says any given school, how many of their students went on to the University of Wisconsin and then had to take remedial courses.
And one of the sticking points looked like who this information was going to be provided to.
Well, the way the bill is written is that it would be given to the legislature in aggregate form. Once it's there, it's about as public as it gets. It can be distributed pretty widely you know, to whoever would want it.
All right. And now some environmental legislation in the Senate banning, and this is a, it sounds like it's a trend around the country, banning microbeads. These are little bits of plastic found in some personal care products. So why is this coming before the legislature?
Illinois recently did this, and the Senate today passed this. It now goes to the Assembly. The concern here is that these tiny beads that are used like as exfoliants in lotions and shampoos, or you know, body scrubs and things like that, can wash down drains and get flushed into Lake Michigan, other bodies of water. Fish can confuse them for fish eggs and eat them, and then those persist in the environment. You know, shorebirds that eat those fish, humans that eat those fish could consume those, and the industry seems to be phasing these out. This bill would just say by a certain date that they could no longer be sold in Wisconsin.
This is one of the first interviews I remember here on Central Time in the early days, talking about the impact on fish in Lake Superior. So this goes back a little ways. Is this one of those things that seems to be getting bipartisan support in the legislature?
It does. They didn't. They voted it by voice today. It was, you know, there was no sign of any dissent. Senator Bob Warch has a different bill that would mandate these be stopped sooner, so he thought it was that the bill should have been more stringent than it is. But everybody, at least in the Senate, was on board. We'll see how it fares in the Assembly.
All right, from the environment to alcohol, one bill would let us sample hard liquor, spirits, in places like grocery stores and liquor stores. What would change?
This idea has been around for a number of years in slightly different forms. This would, if you were in a liquor store and somebody were there trying to sample gin or bourbon or something, you could have a sample of that. The proponents of this, again, this passed very widely today in the Senate, say that you can sample beer, you can sample wine. If you're sampling a small amount of hard liquor, then there shouldn't be any concern. The bill says that you can only have one sample, half ounces, the maximum size of that sample, per day. So they say that there are enough controls to prevent people from coming in and doing a bunch of shots and getting behind the wheel of a car.
And do we expect the Assembly to sign off on that one, too?
The Assembly has passed that
bill.
They have. It now goes to Governor Walker. We haven't heard from him whether he would support it. This did come out of the legislature with a pretty broad support.
And we've been hearing in the news today increasing the speed limit in Wisconsin. We talked to the sponsor, the author of this legislation earlier on the show. What would change under this one? Passed the Assembly in the Senate today, I think?
It passed the Assembly today. Its fate is unclear in the Senate. This would say that the speed limit could go on highways up to 70. Currently, it's 65 is the maximum. The Assembly passed this a year or two back, and the Senate had some safety concerns. It didn't pass, so they're making a new attempt at it. This would give all of the discretion to the State Department of Transportation, so they would determine which portions of which highways would go to 70 miles an hour. They're hoping that that will alleviate the concerns of the senators, or some of the senators, because it'll be in the hands of safety engineers to determine, or you know, traffic engineers to determine which areas can take that speed. The supporters of it note that you can drive from Pennsylvania all the way across the country to Washington State, and the only state you would go through that didn't allow a maximum speed limit of 70 or higher is Wisconsin.
So we hit some of the, as you said, public interest issues that a lot of people might be interested in. Any other interesting items of note today in the legislature, Patrick?
I think that about hits it. There was an appointment that got a little bit of attention in the Senate. Usually appointments go through pretty smoothly, but there was one for a guy named Andrew Hitt, who was appointed to the University of Wisconsin Hospitals and Clinics Authority. And he helped set up Our American Revival, which is Governor Scott Walker's sort of campaign in waiting for the presidency. And then after he had done that work, he was appointed to this board by the governor. Possible he was appointed a little before that happened. But at any rate, the Democrats in the Senate saw that as political payback, so they all voted against it and made some noise about that one.
And I heard a fire alarm in the Assembly today?
Oh, we get some fire alarms in the Capitol from time to time, and so we had one that happened. The Senate had left by then, but it did disrupt the Assembly a little bit. And I can attest that the fire alarms in the Capitol are extremely loud.
All right. Well, Patrick, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
That was Patrick Marley. He is state government reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
We're looking at the diversity gap in Hollywood. Even though the population of the United States is increasingly diverse, Hollywood keeps casting mostly white, mostly male actors in TV and movies.
Our next guest says this isn't just bad because of the lack of diversity itself. It's bad for the bottom line. Darnell Hunt joins us now. He's professor of sociology and director of the Ralph J. Bunche Center for African American Studies at UCLA. He's the author of the second annual Hollywood Diversity Report. Darnell, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, my pleasure.
So, big picture, how big is the diversity gap in the movie and TV industry?
It's pretty big. America currently is somewhere between 37 and 40% minority, and Hollywood just really hasn't kept up. If you look at most of the major arenas, in front of the camera, behind the camera, we find that minorities and women are woefully underrepresented. Among film leads, for example, minorities are underrepresented by a factor of about 2 to 1, which is pretty large. Women also about 2 to 1. Women make up a little bit more than 50% of the population, but they're only about 25-26% of film leads. Minorities somewhere around 17-18%. Same is true with film directors, about 2 to 1 for minorities, 8 to 1 for women. I mean, this is a particularly bad arena for women. It's really unusual when you find a woman directing a major Hollywood film, which is one of the reasons why it was so disappointing, I think, that Ava DuVernay wasn't nominated, didn't win Best Director for Selma. You know, it's very rare you have a woman directing a film, but a woman of color is even rarer, so that was a real missed opportunity. Among writers, we have a similar situation, about 3 to 1 for minorities, a little bit less than 4 to 1 for women. And then if you start looking at television, you find similar patterns. Scripted leads in broadcast television, a little bit less than 6 to 1 underrepresentation for minorities, a little bit less than 2 to 1 for women.
Just to jump.
I mean, there really aren't very many places where you find proportionate representation for either women or minorities in film or television.
Just to zoom in on cast in particular, surveys show that audiences prefer casts that are moderately diverse, it looks like. So what's the problem knowing that? Why aren't there more diverse casts?
Yeah, well, you know, we, in our study for the first time, tried to look at the relationship between diversity and the bottom line. So we looked at household ratings by race. We also looked at 18 to 49 ratings. And what we found consistently, and this is the second year of our study, we're doing this every year because we want to track this over time. What we're finding consistently is that TV programs and films with casts that roughly mirror the diversity of American society, that is somewhere between 30 and 40% minority, on average do the best. And so, yeah, you would think that if that were the case, that Hollywood would get the memo and suddenly start making lots of projects that are diverse like this. Unfortunately, that's not the case. And what we find is that most films and TV shows that are made today are much less diverse in terms of cast than is the broader society. And so the question is, why? I think it's because of kind of a misalignment of interests. On the one hand, you have you know, the industry as a whole. You have individual companies like an ABC Disney or a Sony Studios or whatever. Clearly, it's in their interest to produce projects that are going to appeal to the largest market segment possible, which means that they would ideally make diverse projects if that's what they know the public wants. But at the same time, you have individuals, typically white men, who are in decision-making positions, who are in a very lucrative industry, making lots of money. They can be somewhat risk averse. They have certain, you know, particular experiences that they themselves have had throughout their lives. They're comfortable with making certain types of projects. They're comfortable with working around certain types of people who most of the time look like themselves, think like themselves, and so forth. And they surround themselves with these people, and they make those types of projects, and they make them over and over again. And that's why we see, you know, most projects not necessarily reflecting what the market clearly wants. And the other point to underscore is that the market is becoming more diverse, not less. And so, you know, as we move forward, these patterns, I think, are going to become more pronounced.
Well, my understanding as a Hollywood outsider is that of all the businesses in the world, connections and contacts really matter if you want to make it as a performer, as a director, a producer, anything like that. So is part of the problem that it's who you know, and if you know people like you and those people are white males, this is just going to keep perpetuating itself over time?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, I'm a sociologist, so what I'm trying to understand is the structure of the industry and how the structure tends to reproduce business as usual, and that's what we see. So I think you're exactly right. It's a very networky industry. You get a job because you know someone, and moreover, the person who's doing the hiring feels comfortable with you, and they think that, you know, being surrounded with people like you will increase their odds for success. I mean, it's an industry where most new TV shows fail and most movies underperform, so it's always a crapshoot, and so people are, you know, making decisions based on what they think will produce for them the best odds of success. When in fact, often those decisions are wrong, because I would argue that having more diverse perspectives and voices in the room would actually increase your odds, but that's not the way they see it from their, you know, narrow vantage point. That's one of the reasons why over time we see more or less the same types of patterns rather than wholesale changes. I mean, there have been, you know, increases over the years in terms of minority and women participation, but the problem is those increases haven't kept up with the increasing diversity of American society.
How do the diversity profiles of say, TV compare to the film industry?
Well, film is always a few steps behind television. It's bad in TV, it's worse in film, and so that's pretty much true on every front. For example, I think I mentioned that stat about women directors in film, about 8-1 underrepresentation. In television, it's bad, but not quite that bad. The same would be true for, writing and so forth and so on. So I think part of the issue is there aren't that many major feature films made each year compared to television where, you know, in our sample, well, it's not really a sample, it's a population because we're looking at everything. There are almost 1,110 TV shows that we're actually looking at. And yes, there are that many shows if you count broadcast, cable, and digital. In film, you know, there may be a couple of hundred, you know, major films. In fact, we look at the top 200 by box office. And so, you know, when they're deciding who to entrust a $100 million budget to, most of the time they're not going to look at a woman and they're not going to look at a minority to make those films. Whereas in television, particularly in cable with niche marketed networks, of course you have a BET on cable, you have a TV1, you have an El Rey network, you have a few more opportunities for minorities in particular to lead television shows, cable shows, that type of thing.
Is there a certain over-judgment of, say, movies and TV shows with female or minority leads? I mean, if a female-led superhero movie, say, bombs, maybe producers right. Say, okay, we're not doing more of those. But if, like, a white guy superhero movie bombs, they're not going to stop making white guy superhero movies.
Well, I think you're exactly right. I mean, that's a common criticism I hear by frustrated talent in the industry. You know, we get one shot, and if it doesn't make a ton of money, then that's it. It's never going to happen again for, like, another decade or something. Whereas the norm is to make lots of films with white male leads, directed by white men, written by white men. And again, most of those projects underperform. They don't make as much money as, you know, they might, and certainly they're not held to the same standard that projects produced by minorities and women are held to. Typically, when you have a woman director or a minority director lead a film, it's going to be a lower-budget film. They're not going to give it the type of budget. They're not going to market it with the same support that you're going to get from, you know, one of your major A-lister-type films, blockbuster, that type of thing. So, I think there are a number of different standards operating in the industry, and unfortunately, women and minorities are on the wrong side of them.
Now, when we look at the progress that's been made, is it a sweeping upward trajectory where we just keep moving forward, or are we sort of zigzagging back and forth here in terms of getting more diversity profiles going?
Well, it depends on your time frame. I mean, if you look over the long haul, like, say, over 20 years, clearly there's an upward trend in diversity. The problem, again, is the gap is actually getting bigger between where the industry is and where America is, because America is diversifying more quickly than the industry. If you look at it, say, with like a time horizon of, say, 5 years, you may see zigzagging, ebbing and flowing. We may make a little progress. For example, in 2013, which people have referred to as the year of the breakout black film. That was the year that 12 Years a Slave came out, The Butler, etc. There was a big spike in the number of minority directors, pretty much all attributable to those films, and Fruitvale Station also. And there was also an increase in minority leads that year. But then, you know, I'm expecting they'll probably dip back down a little bit this year. And so, you know, it kind of goes ebbs and flows because there's so few projects that, that prominently feature minorities. If you have one or two breakout projects, then that could really skew the statistics, you know. So it really, I think, is more prudent to kind of look at this over the long term, which is why we're doing this study every year, because we want to be able to say over a 10-year period, this is the slope of the line, and there does appear to be, you know, a trend of sorts that we can actually document.
America keeps on getting more diverse, and yet the Oscars this year got a lot of press for being one of the whitest Oscars in a long time. But given these disparities, how optimistic are you that what's on screen will start to look like the rest of the world?
Well, you know, I'm cautiously optimistic. I mean, I feel that the handwriting is on the wall, and, you know, as we do the study every year, it becomes more and more difficult to refute the bottom line, the findings, that not only is America becoming more diverse, but an increasingly diverse market is demanding increasingly diverse material. One of the reasons why you have shows like Empire and How to Get Away with Murder, Fresh Off the Boat, Blackish, just really exploding this year, because they are tapping into a hunger that the mainstream networks and studios just haven't been satisfying. So I think that, you know, as more of that happens, it'll become hard for the mainstream industry to just ignore it. Now, the question is, how well will they address those needs? If they continue to try to mimic and just copy what's been successful by putting it through the same old process, that is to say, by having white men in charge making all the creative decisions, then they're going to fail because they're not going to produce material that's going to resonate with the sensibilities and the experiences of these increasingly diverse audiences. In other words, they're going to have to get women and people of color behind the scenes as well, as writers, as directors, as showrunners, and so forth. And to the degree that they do that, I think that, you know, there'll be a much more viable industry.
Darnell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Darnell Hunt, professor of sociology and director of the Ralph J. Bunche Center for African American Studies at UCLA. He was with us to talk about the second annual Hollywood Diversity Report.